I have to tell the people about the Patreon.
Yes, you do. Patreon.com/SMDB. SMDB, like so many damn books.
For just a dollar, you can join up and you get access to all the exclusive content that I record just for the Patreon. Also, you get to join the book club. Oh, there's so many damn books book club. It's been some of the best conversations I've had about books.
It really always sounds like a blast. I'll usually like come home and just hear like giggles coming from the library. So it's a great time. You should join.
And I would love to have more people join the fray.
You may or may not know that Christopher runs this whole show himself on the hosting side, on the technical side, everything. This is a one-man show, truly. He does it all. Support your boy, Christopher.
Even at the dollar level really helps. So join up. Patreon.com/SMDB. I'd love to have you.
Patreon.com/SMDB.
On with the show. What?
I was going to say, let's hit it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Did you want to say that?
Let's hit it.
Okay, great.
So many damn books.
Welcome to So Many Damn Books. I am Christopher.
I'm Drew.
And we have Catherine Faw in this damn library with us this afternoon. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you.
Catherine is the author of Young God previously and now Ultra Luminous, which came out in December. And we are so excited to have you on the show. Thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
I'm excited to have you here. This was a crazy book.
Yeah.
A really crazy one.
You got a crazy drink to match it too.
Yeah, this is definitely inspired by the book. There's a drink that the main character drinks over and over, and she doesn't seem to actually. I don't know if she actually likes drinking it. She just keeps ordering it and having it at this one bar, and it's just cherry vodka and Red Bull. I didn't want to make just cherry vodka and Red Bull though. I wanted to do a. I know that tequila is one of the few alcohols that is also a stimulant. I don't know if that's actually true. That's something that I've just been repeating since I heard it in college. but I think it is, and it might make sense for why people get a little crazy on tequila.
Mm-hmm.
So I started with tequila for kind of being the Red Bull of it all. And then I did cherry lemonade, and then some basil. And some roasted cacao's simple syrup. And I shake that up. And a little bit of like mashing of the basil and everything. Yeah. I don't know. It's good.
It's a yummy one.
What's it called?
Oh, yeah. I'm calling it The Polish.
Nice.
And it's because another reference to the book, that she's constantly getting manicures with very, you know, the art seems to really connect with what's happening in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll get to that. First
we have other things to do.
First, we have capitalism.
Yes, we do.
Yes. Christopher, would you like to start?
No, you should.
Okay. I picked up a copy of this book called Heartland. That's, I think, just out from Restless Books.
Mm-hmm.
It's by Anna Simo. It her debut novel. She's 74 years old. Mm. She's a fixture of like the downtown New York theater and performance scene. She like founded the Lesbian Avengers. She is like one of the first artists to have performances at most of the major theaters downtown. She's just this like crazy, awesome spitfire woman. And she has turned her hand towards novel writing. And I heard it was coming out. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, I'll read that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm stoked to see what it's like.
It makes me happy that you can still debut at 74.
Yeah.
Because that gives me hope that someday, someday I can finish my book.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll be when I'm 74. Cool.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk about what you bought?
Yeah, I haven't actually bought this book yet, but I'm intending to buy it. And it is by Fleur Yagi, who is the writer that we'll be talking about later. And it's her book called SS Proleturka.
Mm-hmm.
And It's about her and her, it's fiction, but it, I think it's pretty autobiographical. And it's about her and her dad on this ship. And it's very short, like all her books, maybe 100 pages. But I'm really into her as a writer right now, and I want to check it out. So that's what I'm going to be buying soon.
Nice.
Cool.
I love it.
Yeah, I definitely need to go pick up more of her stuff.
Yeah, this was Sweet Days of Discipline was so fascinating.
Yeah.
Very weird writing.
Yeah.
But like, yeah. Well, we will get to this. we keep getting ahead of ourselves because we're excited about the books.
Yeah. All right, Christopher, what'd you buy?
So I was at Catapult, which also houses like Soft Skull Press and Black Balloon, and they graciously handed me a copy of I, Parrot, which is a graphic novel written by Deb Olin Unferth.
How do I know that name?
She has done a bunch of stuff.
She's great.
She's great. One of my favorite encounters of Deb Olin Unferth is with she did this flash fiction collection along with Sarah Manguso and Dave Eggers, and it's like three books in a tiny box.
Yeah, that's why I know. Yes.
And so this though is she wrote it, and it was illustrated by Elizabeth Hadle, and I don't know anything really about it, except for it's a graphic novel called I, Parrot.
Cool.
So I'm really excited to check that out. And yeah, I love being in those little small press, like an indie press office, because there's books just towering everywhere. It just looks like, I don't know, art is happening.
I love Catapult too. One of my really good friends, Yuka, is the editor of Soft Skull now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. They're really great. They've been putting out some amazing books in their short life so far.
I know. And it's so cool that they merged with Soft Skull, which has been a long time purveyor of weird, awesome books.
Yeah. It's like a sort of a Voltron sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're like teaming up to be even better.
Yeah. It's exactly like, that's probably really how they...
Pitched it?
Their articles of incorporation. Just like Voltron.
Signed.
Yeah.
yeah.
So that's it.
That's it.
Well, let's turn our minds over to Ultra Luminous, your new novel. Do you mind telling everybody who's listening who might not have encountered it yet what it's about?
Sure. Ultra Luminous is about a prostitute, kind of a girlfriend experience escort. She's very expensive. Her rate is very high, and she provides kind of this experience of having a girlfriend when you buy her services. Mm-hmm. So you take her out to dinner, and she stays overnight, and so she's the main character of the book, and it starts with her coming back to New York, where she grew up, after she's been gone for 15 years in Dubai. And it's just kind of a one-year record of her life back in New York. And I won't say more because I don't want to give away the...
Yeah, well, there's...
What happens.
Yeah.
There was... it's interesting. Some of the jacket copy, I feel like if you can just pick up this book and not read, just like jump right in.
I
highly recommend that.
Yeah.
Because there's some stuff that I think the jacket copy doesn't need to necessarily tell you that would have been fun to experience without.
Right.
But whatever. I don't actually believe in spoilers very much. So
there's something about this idea of what do you put on the jacket versus what do you leave for the reader to discover. And
were you part of any of that conversation? Or
I was, though the jacket copy is really up to the publisher and marketing. But I think for us, there was an element of surprise in this book that we kind of wanted to keep as a surprise. Because mm-hmm. I think it works better that way as a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, once you know what happens, I think you can still go back and read it and get maybe more from it, because you recognize the patterns that are happening in the book a lot more.
Yes.
Yeah. Speaking of patterns, that's something the book felt kind of like a classical symphony to me, in that there are introductions of these moments, and then they recur with changes and with growth and shifts, and then everything kind of breaks before it comes to a resolution. And I'm just curious about how you came to structure the book and how you built the structure of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never thought of it that way, but I do feel like I'm a very rhythmic writer, and I really rely a lot on circling back to phrases and ideas that I've already written and reintroducing them in, further scenes further along in the book. So you encounter them again in a different way, which is, I guess, is a lot like what classical music does, or any music, where you repeat phrases.
Yeah.
But for me, it was a lot about time. I wanted to make a book that kind of mirrored time for her and for me, where I have like a very specific, like, I've always been able to see time in my head. It's like this weird form of synesthesia.
It's
called, like, it's really the most boring form of synesthesia. But but it's, you basically, you just see a timeline in front of you that never changes in your head. So if you tell me a year, like 1974, I will always go to the same place. It's like a shape.
Whoa.
Wow. That's
so interesting. For me, time has always been this shape. So I kind of wanted to make a book that was a shape of time as well, where, you know, every chapter in the book is a week in her life, a week in 1 year. And we see her almost every day because she's extremely orderly. She sees one client on Monday, always on Monday, and the same client always on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see almost every day of her life. So that's the way I wanted to structure it when I was thinking about it.
That's interesting. I get the timing thing, because if we're going to keep using similes here, I kind of thought of it as this novel sort of like, and maybe it's just because I read it sort of close to Thanksgiving, but it's like cooking an elaborate meal. Like, you have to like check in with things. And mm-hmm. so, like, especially with these guys who are appearing sometimes, but not others, I sort of feel like, she hasn't checked in with that guy in a while. I hope he's okay. Like, I hope that's all right. And just like, oh, right. No, like, it's not on fire. You can move to the next. But yeah, it was a very singular reading experience, especially, but it made sense for her as an organized person, and as also just in the tradition of prostitutes in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious if, like, you were thinking about other, because there's the Western hooker with a heart of gold, sort of, and then there's like the, I mean, I keep seeing Bret Easton Ellis talked about in conjunction with you. I don't know how you would feel about that.
You know, I really loved Bret Easton Ellis when I was a teenager, so I don't, you know, he meant a lot to me when I was like 14, and I really, I'm sure those, and American Psycho, I think, is still a really great book that has really still has such resonance, like,
mm-hmm. maybe
even more so today than when it came out. Just how, and it's hilarious. You know, there's whole chapters on his beauty routine and like on going through every song of a horrible Whitney Houston album, you know. But I guess I wasn't really thinking about other prostitutes. I was just thinking about if I was a prostitute, how I would behave. Because I mean, I've never done sex work. I have no idea what that would be like, but I can imagine, I know how men and women relate to each other, I think. And to just make that all about a transaction and a monetary exchange,
mm-hmm.
Though at the same time, it's sex and emotions, and you're never going to be able to take that out of the equation either. I think that was what I was thinking about the most when I was writing. And to me, prostitution was her job. And so I wanted to portray that clearly, which is why I think the sex is really explicit, because I didn't want it to be gauzy or soft focus at all. You know, I wanted it to be like, this is exactly what goes on
mm-hmm.
when a prostitute and a man who has bought her are alone in a hotel room together.
Right.
And that was really important to me.
Right. Right. It's definitely not... Or at least not to me. It wasn't like sexy sex. It was more, it was definitely like transactional feeling.
Yeah.
something I really loved about both of your books is how tight and punchy the whole thing is. Like, every single line has purpose in the way that people say, like, that's what Ernest Hemingway did. Mm-hmm. And you read those books and you're like, if he was cutting all this shit, he could have cut half of these lines. And I've heard you talk about Young God and the process of writing that book.
Right. It was you've told me it was like 100,000 words long before you started slicing at it.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if did you do the same thing with Ultraluminous, or has that become like, have you figured out how to just cut to the core now?
Yeah, I thankfully did not have to do that with Ultraluminous. it just kind of came out that way, and there's not a lot of stuff that I cut. At the same time, it took me the exact same number of years to write, so I don't. There's no shortcut that I've come up with. But yeah, it was, and just her personality. She's a really a no bullshit person because she has seen a lot. She's been a prostitute for 15 years, which is a long time mm-hmm. to be in that world. So she's not romantic about relationships, though she does fall in love. And, you know, she has boyfriends that she cares about a lot, but it's not some teenage idea of sex and romance. She's very, you know, clear about what relationships mean.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'm curious if, you know, these the guys that show up who have good, really good monikers, the creation of these and like, I don't know. I just wanted you to talk about like calf brain guy and guy who buys me things. Like, you know, how well do you know them as characters, or you only see them through Kay's eyes when you're writing it as well?
I mainly saw them through her eyes. I know, and I only really saw her through the eyes of the book. I never, you know, thought about her life outside of the book. That's not something I really do. I'm not a very psychological writer where I have backstories for everybody. So I was interested in them to the extent that she was interested in them, which is she needs to know enough to be able to keep their attention, and just the basic things they show her when she's around them. At the same time, their archetypes or their characters came very easily to me. I'm not sure exactly why, but no. You know, if you live in New York a long time, which I've been here almost 17 years, you encounter a lot of these type of guys. And there's a lot of money in New York, and it's just inevitable that you'll run into a calf spring guy at some point in your life.
And that refers to something that he would eat, ate on a date, and not necessarily his type of himself.
Right.
Although, you know, your mileage may vary.
Yeah. It was neat to see how I can imagine Kay as a supporting character in another book, and like I've seen her on the periphery with each of these individual characters. Like I've seen the artist in real life, and I've seen the junk bond guy, and I've seen calf brain guy, and to see now them become the supporting players,
mm-hmm.
especially at our particular political moment right now, and just to be like, yeah, fuck you guys, I'm interested in her.
Mm-hmm.
That it was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's always something I'm interested in my writing, where I think everything I write is about female ambition, however twisted it comes out. And yeah, I'm always more interested in the women than the men in almost any work of art. You know, I'll be like, what about your wife? What's going on with her? You know, she has like three scenes where she just comforts you, and that's all we know.
Yeah. I liked that the character of the Sheik almost functions in that way.
Right.
Functions like the traditional wife of the powerful main character figure.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh yeah, he's off building bombs or doing whatever he's doing. That's so sweet.
I've heard it said before, and I've experienced this myself, that it's easier to write about something after you've left it and come back. Mm-hmm. I felt like in the novel there was a lot of like her viewpoint of New York was definitely like from after leaving and coming back, like having fresh but not fresh eyes. How did you go about achieving that sort of viewpoint?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's the best way to write about a place, because if you're really in it, it's hard to see it. So it's either you have to be a newcomer or a returnee. And it was fun because I've always wanted to write about the changes in New York. I mean, I've lived here since 2001, so I haven't seen the really momentous changes, but it has changed a lot since even I moved here. I love it. It's the place I want to live for the rest of my life, and it's given me so much. But at the same time, it can feel so alien sometimes when you're walking around and you don't understand anymore where you fit in the city, and you're like constantly reevaluating that even when you don't leave, just because there's such turnover and there's everything's changing all the time.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from North Carolina originally.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that gives you a certain viewpoint, I guess, too.
Yeah.
Did you come here for writing in 2001?
Yeah, I came here to go to NYU. I actually went to Tisch. I thought I was going to be a filmmaker, did not pan out. I wanted to come here since I was probably 12, and I just like single-mindedly made that happen. It was always the place I knew where I felt most myself, which is true. I still feel most like myself in New York, but there's often this like alienation that I experience all the time. Because like, a bodega that you've been going to for 10 years will suddenly just close and turn into like a fancy coffee shop. And it can be really disorienting.
Mm. I walked into a Duane Reade and got a couple of things and left, got on the subway, and it was the first time that she goes into a Duane Reade and buys sushi.
Mm-hmm.
And for like that image just stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And that the weirdness of like, that doesn't feel like what you picture New York as. You picture like the good sushi place and your bodega and all of these things. And to see all of those things sort of coming together in this one slightly dangerous package.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also curious if you've had Duane Reade sushi.
I have not. I'm not that suicidal. I mean, it may be delicious. I have no idea. But that was always just a joke I had with myself that, when I moved here, Duane Reade's were really funky. Like, they were just the hometown pharmacy, and everything was dusty, and, it was very New York. Everything, it's like when you return from overseas and you go into JFK for passport control, and it's just like, a basement full of chaos. It was exactly like that. And that's how New York always will be, I think. I don't think they'll ever go away. But at some point in the last maybe 8 or 9 years, Duane Reade got bought by Walgreens. And overnight, it felt like it just became this suburban, very clean, spotless store where suddenly there was sushi. And every time I saw it, I just thought, what kind of person would buy this?
Yeah.
And then when I started writing this book, I was like, she would buy this.
Another thing that you check in on that isn't sushi or the guys is her nail polish, which I kept clocking just because she gets such interesting designs, like the life support or the the EKG readout on one. And I had to do it myself. I put some polish on my nails, and I'm already noticing, like, you notice your hands or you notice yourself in a different way every time. And so they just functioned as an image before, but now I'm sort of seeing them as like what they might do for her character of like trying to feel like a different person. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, your nail polish looks fabulous, by the way.
Just on my thumbs. It makes me laugh every time I text.
Yeah, I mean, she's also part of being a prostitute. I mean, and also just being a certain kind of woman is a lot of maintenance, a lot of beauty maintenance. And so a lot of the book is spent, with her taking care of her appearance, because that is her most valuable asset. And she worries about getting old, too, because she's in the book in her mid-30s, which unfortunately for women is starting to age out. So the getting her nails done is also a very New York thing, where women in other cities don't get manicures like women in New York do. But So I wanted her, it would just be a natural thing for her to do as part of her life here. At the same time, she's totally obsessed with patterns. And so she will look for them everywhere and she'll also create them. And that's what she does with her nails a lot, where she'll just ask for, you know, something that's been on her mind, like the life support, or, you know, she'll do private jokes with herself when she gets wall and door on her fingernails.
Yeah,
that's right. You mentioned girlhood, and that just makes me think immediately of the book you brought that you had us read, Sweet Days of Discipline by Flair Yeagy, which is also, but it's about a very different type of girlhood, obviously, since it's a, since it's a 12 to 14 year old girl in boarding school, although it's a woman at some indeterminate age looking back at her girlhood of 12 to 14 at boarding school. Do you want to add to that of what Sweet Days of Discipline and why you brought it?
Yeah, I just heard about Flair Yeagy recently. I think there was a New Yorker article about her, and I was totally intrigued because she was described as having, you know, no interest in redemption or psychological concerns or catering to the reader at all. And also she wrote very short books like I tend to do. So, And this book, Sweet Days of Discipline, has been described as her masterpiece. And so I wanted to start with that. And yeah, it's about she herself was in boarding school in Switzerland for most of her childhood. And this book takes place in a boarding school in Switzerland.
Yeah, it's a strangely organized novel as well, because the timeline's a little like gauzy. You don't quite know, like, even like someone will have been written out of the book. It seems like they'll have left the boarding school, but she'll keep referring to them and talking to them again. And little things like that happen all over the place. But I just was, I was so interested already in the world. I love boarding school novels in general, but she as the character is constantly like looking at the way that like everybody's clothes are either perfectly or not perfectly like apportioned in their little cubbies, and just their whole universe seemed like very small and compact, and like everything had to slot into a very specific space, which I can see why that would make for a 12 to 14 year old morose, sad girl. It just seems like some of the thoughts that are attributed to her are seem like really wise beyond her years sometimes, but other times it seems like, oh yeah, a 12 to 14 year old would totally think that. I'm going to just bring up this one thing that I flagged. Many of the girls possess diaries with little brass studs with keys. They think they possess their lives.
Oof. Yeah.
There's little moments like that, which you stop. Like it is like poetry in that same way.
There's menace is not quite the right word, but there is a darkness that is shot through this book, and it's lines like that. And I think it is the way that you're saying it, that idea that it is clearly somebody older looking back, but also somehow channeling what it was like to be at that age. Mm-hmm. And so the young girl almost takes on this preternatural like intelligence in that way that, yeah, any kid who is like wise beyond their years, there's something just like a little unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, she's an operator.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you have to keep reminding yourself that she's like 12 to 14?
No. I guess I have been a 12-year-old girl, so I kind of know what it's like. And you're way more mature than you look, which is dangerous. And girls do mature a lot faster than boys. So you're kind of, I mean, maybe you're like the equivalent of a 20-year-old boy, you know, in your like, yeah. You know, mental. In everything,
yeah.
You know, you're adolescent, you're, you know, so I wasn't surprised by any of that. I guess what struck me the most about the novel was it was so cold and so hot at the same time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's got this crush, or it seems like girls sort of pair off.
Mm-hmm.
It's that's how she sort of sees the world anyway, is that like people like choose their one girl and that's their best friend and they always are together. And so she's chosen this nihilist, Frederic, who just kept the first time that she sees her, she's like, I want to destroy that girl.
Yeah.
Which is that menace that you're talking about. And then like the next page, she wants to be best friends with her. Which is, again, that's not a state of mind that I quite, that I was interested to read, but it wasn't something that I recognized.
Yeah, I feel like I do. It's very competitive between women, especially at that age when you're first kind of recognizing that you're a sexual being and that a lot of it depends on your looks and how, and so there's a lot of just sizing up other girls and trying to, you know, am I prettier than her? Is she prettier than me? How do I like conquer this thing? So, or maybe it's just me. Maybe I just, maybe Fleur and I are just the same type of girl. I don't know.
Yeah, she seems to think like deep beauty is almost like to her is like a flaw or like a sign of frivolity. Like there's a character that comes in later, this woman, Micheline, who she's like, she's so much fun. She like jokes around all the time and she's too beautiful. Like I can't take her seriously.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of some of Megan Abbott's books, like Dare Me and
You Will Know Me.
Yeah, just like watching these whiplash turns of sizing each other up and being like, oh, today we're gonna be friends, but like that might not be true tomorrow, and adding that into this sort of hazier structure of time, and yeah, characters who keep popping back in. I found that it was. I had to pay attention in a way that I don't always have to do with a novel. Mm. Like I couldn't let this one just wash over me. I feel like I had to really dig in, and I'm wondering if that was the same for either of you or if it did just like you let it wash over you.
No, I actually read it twice.
Cool.
Yeah. The first time I read it was kind of drawn out. I mean, it's very short. It's 100 pages, but I was just doing a lot of other things. So it was kind of spread out over a couple weeks. And then I just felt like I was missing something. And so a couple of days ago, I read the whole thing in 2 days. Mm-hmm. And it was so much more powerful when it was condensed like that. And I was really paying attention. I also looked up everything I didn't understand because there's a lot of phrases in German and French that aren't translated. And a lot of just cultural things I didn't know.
But sometimes
about.
They are translated too.
Which, right, it's true. Yeah.
Which I thought was really strange. I actually, I was thinking of John Knowles' A Separate Piece while I was reading this, just for like the, I guess like the male version. Mm-hmm. And the male version, like they would never admit to any sort of like crush or like love as the main character here, which is she named and I'm just forgetting it, or is it just like the narrator?
I don't think she's ever named.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Anyway, but I just think that's so interesting that like, it's like page one of their, not of the book, but of their like relationship that she's like, yeah, I sort of have a crush on this girl. And I just don't think that the boys in A Separate Piece would ever be able to do that, even though that's also what's going on.
Right.
In a way, they're just, he's so interested in that sort of beautiful boy.
Thinking about the looking things up, there was one thing that caught in my mind, and I don't know why, when she's talking about the fact that her mother now lives in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one line where they're talking about sort of, because this takes place in, I think, the early 50s. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of the aftermath of the war. And it hit me that like, she might be the daughter of a Nazi. Mm. Because a bunch of the Nazis fled Germany to Brazil.
Mm.
And there were just some of these weird structural things and the conversations and the oddities, the daughter of an African king, mm-hmm. African president, I forget.
President.
African president shows up and everybody is sort of fascinated. Like the teachers are fascinated by this woman. Right. Except for her. She's sort of like, oh, whatever. But I when I finally pegged the book in time, I started thinking about all of these things, and I went down like a Wikipedia rabbit hole of like, oh wow, yeah, the Nazis went to South America, crazy.
That's so interesting to sort of put her there, although she's not.
She's Swiss, so
right.
I'm not totally sure, but I would assume that her parents were neutral and out of it. But she does. She has a German roommate mm-hmm. who she's always yeah. talking about as her parents were most definitely Nazis.
Yeah,
and that this girl grew up in Nuremberg, you know, in the rubble, and that she would never even say the word war. And I think there's a line in the book where the main character always wanted to ask her if she knew if she had known Hitler,
mm-hmm.
but she never she never did.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, that whole relationship. Is so funny because she introduces that German roommate as like, I barely remember her. I don't
right.
even know anything about that girl. Like, I can't even think of her face. But then like, that's so not true. Like, she knows her so deeply, but she obviously had a very, I don't know, that relationship is very fraught.
Yeah.
Because she...
Yeah.
She shares such intimate moments with her, but she's also like completely cold. I mean, that's what kept coming up, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is, it's very chilly, but at the same time, there is this like burning fire underneath and where it's like so melodramatic. A lot of what she talks about is so like that teenage first love you have.
Right.
And that was what was most interesting to me. It was like this very strange, mixture that really worked for me.
Right. I mean you keep expecting like a romance to come to something like
yeah.
like a I guess in a traditional novel they would, right? Like something would break
mm-hmm.
and she would either actually hook up with Frederick or something or not. But that's just not what she's up to.
Right.
Instead, I don't know what did she accomplish instead? I was so transfixed by it, but I'm not sure exactly what I'm left with. Other than a lot of like hazy notions.
Yeah. Oh, I think the ending complicates it too. When she sees Frederick again later in life.
Right. And we don't even know how much later or.
Yeah. Like, it's clear that some decent chunk of time has passed, but it's unclear now where the narrator is in her life and what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you sort of end up with that question of like, what were you trying to do in all of these cases?
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, just in a real book club-y question. Would you guys, did you ever like dream or want to go to boarding school, or did you? I don't know.
I definitely did not go to boarding school. I grew up in Appalachia and went to very terrible public schools. But yeah, I've always thought it would... I'm kind of glad I didn't, just because it seems, like a hothouse, like where you never like escape your classmates.
Right.
You're with them all the time.
Yeah.
How about you guys?
I did not. I went to public schools outside of Philadelphia, and like I had friends who even just went to private schools, and even that culture. Like a friend of mine went to an all boys school for middle school, and it was just, he came out of it a completely different, way more monstrous human being. And so while I enjoy reading, especially English novels about boarding school, I'm very happy to have not had that experience myself.
Yeah. I think it's just sort of like, maybe it's just because of Harry Potter. Just like that boarding school just seemed there's so much magic there, but even not like in
actual
Skippy,
magic,
actual magic. But in, you know, Skippy Dies or mm-hmm. A Separate Piece or even the Great Brain novels. I don't know if you guys read those as kids.
No,
they are fantastic, and I don't even know if they're in print anymore, and they should be. But they kind of paint them as like this sort of like there's a lot of mischief that one can get into. But maybe I think I've really only read the all boys ones or the co-ed ones, I guess, if it's Harry Potter.
Did you read The Secret Place, either of you, by Tana French?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did.
That one, I think that's an all-girl school, and I think some of them are boarders.
Right.
But but not everybody, which is also, that's a complication in and of itself.
Right. This is unlike any boarding school novel. And it's not, you know, usually I feel like the boarding school novel, it gives you this lovely structure of how, like, school is structured. Like, you get there and you meet people, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have your semesters that you're using for melodramatic moments of, like, oh God, finals and my crush.
Right.
Or whatever. And this is like, there's none of that use of the structure of a year at school at all. Which is great. I mean, it's so much of this Sweet Days of Discipline catches you off guard.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the one more thing I wanted to ask about this book was if that made sense to you, the Sweet Days of Discipline. Like, she sort of is looking back at this and saying, like, it was nice to have order and someone to, like, be, like, above you, telling you what to do. And it was a nice memory for her. I mean, that was something that I was sort of intrigued by. I'm just curious if you guys like that as well.
I did see that for sure. I saw it as her reflecting on how the structure and discipline of her time allowed her to think about these other things and get up to, maybe not mischief in, like, the traditional sense, but the structure and discipline of the school allowed her to have these thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's someone who's obsessed with order and chaos, which is interesting because Kay in my book is also obsessed with order and chaos. And the fact that everything you do to order the universe is ultimately useless. At the same time, she's obsessed with finding patterns but order. And what was most interesting to me when she saw Frederick again at the end is Frederick is, like, living in this squat or something, you know, with no heat, and she's totally life of, like, a saint or something is how it's described. It's just total nihilism. Mm-hmm. And the narrator says, oh yes, Frederick has moved ahead of me again, and I can't understand her again. She's, you know, she's doing something that's in the future and I can't understand it. And I think that was my takeaway from the novel, is that that the writer is always going to try to reach this state that Frederick got into through madness, because she's insane.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually the, like, antithesis of order and discipline,
mm-hmm.
but it's so close to it.
Right.
And it's kind of like where it all may lead you.
Right. I feel like you're, of course, just because you brought it to us, I was thinking of the two books in concert, but there is a lot of similarities of, like, the structure and as well as the just section to section and like tight poetry.
Yeah, it's a neat pairing. I would recommend
both of them
if you have the opportunity. Yeah, back to back. Because there is, I did that, and there is something when you are thinking about questions of order versus chaos and the way that the two intermingle. Both books started to do that a little bit and started to intermingle a little bit for me.
Mm-hmm. Should we talk about other things we endorse too?
Sure.
Yeah, let's move to recommendations.
Okay.
You want to start?
Sure. Another short novel that kind of intermingles order and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Valeria Lucelli's first novel, Faces in the Crowd. I finally got around to reading it. At work, the public did a staff book club, and we read her Tell Me How It Ends essay. And I had read that last year, but in preparation for it, I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to dive into her first novel. It's the only thing I hadn't read. And it is so cool and trippy, and she's writing as like a young mother who has just moved to Mexico and is remembering her time as, like, a wild youth in New York. And then she's also trying to write a novel about Gilberto Owen, the poet, in New York, and the three narratives start to blend together, and she's changing almost every paragraph. It shifts who the narrator is, but some of these scenes can apply to two or three of the narrative moments. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprising, like, head twister in a way that I went into it expecting something a little bit challenging, but by no means what it was.
Wow.
So I really dug that.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Yeah.
I actually have that at home and I have never read it. I'm going to do that now.
Cool. Nice.
Do you want to go next?
Sure. I've been on a whole Russian kick this whole year where I've basically only been reading Russian books, weirdly. I've always been fascinated with Russia. But I just read Chekhov's nonfiction book about a penal colony called Sakhalin Islands. It's very long, and I hesitate to recommend it because it'll only be for a certain type of reader. I mean, it's probably like 500 pages and 300 pages of notes, but I was so into it.
Cool.
So who is that certain type of reader?
I guess someone like me. I don't know. he wrote this. It was before he wrote any of his most famous plays or short stories, and he had just found out that he had tuberculosis. Mm. So he decided that he would take this trek all the way across Siberia to the end of Russia. It's in the very far east. It's this island that's just above Korea. It took, I think, 3 or 4 months for him just to get there. It definitely took a few years off his life. and he went there and he went to every single settlement on the island and took a census of everyone. And of course, he was a practicing doctor, so he also offered medical care to the prisoners there. And it's kind of just, in a way, an expose about the czarist system of punishment, which the exile system, which pretty much persists to this day in Russia, where people are sent to whatever they call the gulag now.
Yeah.
You know, just they're sent away across Siberia to a prison. I mean, it's been around for a long time, the practice of it. And it was just written so beautifully and, you know, typical Chekhov, you know, style. And it just had every emotion you could think of packed into this book, because it was these extreme circumstances where people were exiled for life and could never go back to Russia. And there's an amazing chapter just on the death penalty and how they often got it wrong. It would save people at the very last second. Like, oof. They would have like a noose around their neck and they'd be like, no, just take it off. You know, it's kind of an amazing book. If you can read 500 pages with 300 pages of notes.
I kind of do want to read that. I've read all of Chekhov's plays and I know some of his short fiction. But that, it sounds like the perfect thing to task him to write.
Mm.
Like, it just feels like he would have the right amount of empathy and the right amount of distance to be, yeah. I'm going to have to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, Christopher?
Yeah, I'm not going to recommend a book this time. I'm going to recommend a podcast.
Okay. So, I've heard of those.
Yeah. We like them. This one is called Heaven's Gate. And it is about the cult Heaven's Gate, which I've always been fascinated by since I stumbled across that very unsettling goodbye video. So I don't, if you're not familiar with the cult, there was like 40 of them or a few more than 40, and they all killed themselves because the Haley Bopp comet was coming and there was the...
They're going to hitch a ride.
They were going to hitch a ride in the spaceship that was in Haley Bopp Comet's tail.
Right.
Got it.
And they all wore Nike Decades black sneakers with a purple swoosh. And they all wore tracksuits that said Away Team as a like homemade patch.
Oh, my God.
And it's just like all the details of this are like, they sound funny, but they're not
right.
but this goodbye video it haunted me since I've seen it, which is just, it's them like saying goodbye to their families and everything, and they're like completely and utterly lucid and happy, and they're just like, they can't wait. They're just really excited about like going to the next part of their journey. And so it's just very odd. And the way that this podcast is structured, he kind of, the host is taking the tack of, really, this could have happened to anybody. Like, it sounds crazy that this is, but all of these people were really normal. And this is like the first weird thing that they did, a lot of them. Whew. So he's like, this could have happened to you, like, every time.
Wow.
A really, really interesting way to go into it. And then he's like talking to the families and talking about, really talking about like individual members of the cult. So I highly recommend the podcast. It's been one of the most fantastic listens that I've come across in a long time.
Cool.
Wow.
So yeah. Real fun 2018 listening.
Woo!
We're partying now.
Yeah. No, you are partying because you're listening to this show.
Yeah, you're partying listening to this show.
Yeah.
This is the party. I'm going to drink more of this drink. but Catherine, thanks so much for joining
us. Yeah, thank you for coming.
In the damn library.
Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it. And we also really appreciate you, listener, for listening to this show. And also because you've already probably left us an iTunes review at this point. And if you haven't,
you should go check, maybe, just to be safe.
Maybe just go and click 5 stars.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, if you've already done that and you already love the show and you want to even contribute to our coffers, you can do that at patreon.com/smdb.
Boy, it'd be nice to have coffers.
True ones?
Like, yeah. It just implies a certain amount of wealth.
Does it?
To me, it
I
does.
I actually don't know what a coffers is. I've used that phrase for ages now.
Well,
yeah.
Now your secret has been revealed.
That's an R8 secret. As far as secrets revealing goes. All right, well, goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody. Stay warm.
Stay warm, and thanks again, Catherine.
Thank you.